The U.S. government often crafts policies to promote democracy abroad that rely on cooperation with undemocratic governments. In The Democracy Promotion Paradox, a new book from the Brookings Institution Press, author Lincoln Mitchell explores the inconsistencies and paradoxes that lie at the heart of democracy promotion. Here is the BI Press's Bill Finan interviewing Lincoln Mitchell.
I want to begin by asking a central question. Your book, The Democracy Promotion Paradox, what is exactly democracy promotion?
Well, in the book, I define democracy promotion both kind of broadly and kind of narrowly, right? So on the one hand, the most narrow democracy promotion can be a battery of activities mostly funded by the USAID aimed at very technical work, ensuring that electors, monitoring elections to see if they're observed fairly, helping to develop the capacity of a legislature in a democratizing country, helping political party development. But it also, and if we limit it to that, it's a very kind of modest and benign set of programs.
Mm-hmm.
One of the paradoxes is that if you can't just limit it to that, democracy promotion is also something that really is part in very broad strokes of American foreign policy. We see this in national strategy documents. We see this in the statements of secretaries of state and presidents and elected officials. And we see it in, as a often post facto, but not always, explanation of major foreign policy decisions. The obvious example for everyone is the Iraq War in 2003, where after we had gone to the war, President Bush kind of tried to backdoor this as we did this for democracy in Iraq. Now, that obviously wasn't true, and I don't think Bush meant that when the war started. But, you know, that demonstrates that it's both very big and very small. It includes a lot of things, but in a narrower way, it includes very few things. And that's one of the challenges and also one of the paradoxes of democracy promotion.
So I'm going to back up for a moment. We can't think of it as just as some one single exportable product then, right?
You mean democracy?
Yes.
Right.
It's not like exporting the bananas.
And the people who are in the, you know, in the field and in Washington who are serious about this make a great effort to say we're not exporting American-style democracy. We understand that democracy is a broad range of things. It can include institutional arrangements where there are presidential systems or parliamentary systems. It can include various different aspects towards things like the role of religion in political life. So there is a recognition that there's a lot of different possible definitions of democracy. On the other hand, and one of the things I try to argue in the book is there's not always a great recognition of what is democracy, right? This is, obviously you could have graduate seminars and people do them and books about what is democracy. But when the rubber meets the road in democracy promotion, that's often lost. For many people, many people on the American side, well, everyone American knows what democracy is because we have it. So we're just going to, based on that knowledge, try to see what we can do to help make it stronger in other countries. But that's a very tenuous approach.
So what exactly is the paradox then that we're talking here about? You mentioned one early on.
Well, I might rephrase that question if I can and
sure.
Say what exactly are the paradoxes? Because in the book, I really talk about different paradoxes. So there are some kind of very big picture paradoxes and some, you know, smaller, more specific paradoxes. So examples of the former are a democracy promotion paradox is that in 2015 or 2010, and likely will still be the case in 2020, the remaining countries that are not democratic for the unfortunate reason that their leaders don't want to be democratic, right? And which I think intuitively makes sense if you look around the world. But implicit in the notion of democracy promotion, particularly at the programmatic level, is that we want to work with governments. And the reason for that is if you're not working with governments, you create a whole lot of other problems because you are working against governments. So how do you work with a government of a non-democratic state that is committed to staying non-democratic for the, you know, often frequently because of the personal motivations of the people in power, how do you work in that setting to create more democracy, right? So that's one paradox. Another paradox is that democracy promotion is something that only exists as a result of American power, right? Why do we promote democracy? I mean, in the book, I kind of conclude after a lot of discussion that we promote democracy because we can't help it. And that may sound a little trite, but there's some truth to that. We promote democracy because we're the most powerful country in the world, and especially when you include our allies who often work with us on this project, and that's what powerful countries do. On the other hand, democracy is an ideal that is really a political philosophy that really says, well, everyone should make their own decisions, and It shouldn't be the result of political power. So that's a paradox. And where you see this is in this state of a constant, you know, if you just do a Google search on democracy promotion, barrel of a gun, I think I do this at one point in the book, there's always this constant article, you know, democracy can't be promoted at the barrel of a gun. Mm-hmm. Democracy can't be enforced from above. And the reason for that is there's something that the same good liberal instincts that say people should have a right to live in democratic systems also tell you it's not really right to impose it on them. Of course, many people in the democracy promotion field would say we're not imposing, we're nurturing, facilitating. But in my view, that's a very gray area. Of course, one of the paradoxes is that it resonates with our good instincts, our better instincts to say it can't be imposed from above. It can't be done at the barrel of a gun. But I used to teach a class on democracy promotion at Columbia. And on the last day of the class, I would say, and as we know, democracy cannot be implemented at the barrel of a gun. And the proof of that is that Germany and Japan are still fascist countries. And the students would have got halfway through nodding their head, and they'd look at me, realizing that I'd said something that didn't make any sense. So as nice as it is to say that, in fact, democracy has been promoted at the barrel of a gun. Not right. saying that should be our policy, but that's a paradox, right?
So those are three.
There are other. I'm sorry?
I was just going to say those are three paradoxes. I guess how many in total do you think you could enumerate?
Well, I mean, it depends where you when you stop counting. But I think I have been broken down. So there are paradoxes of domestic U.S. policy involved. There are paradoxes. And one of those is that both the left and the right have this kind of, I think, irrational approach to democracy promotion. So a common left-wing critique is that on the one hand, it's wrong to promote democracy at the barrel of a gun. On the other hand, it's ineffective and can't be done because that's not how the world works. Well, if both those things, only one of those things can be true, because if it's not how the world works, then it wouldn't matter whether it was wrong or right, right?
Right.
And if it's really wrong to do it, it's only wrong to do it because it might actually work, right? So there are kind of paradoxes of American kind of domestic policy. There are paradoxes of big picture foreign policy, like the first one I outlined. And then there are paradoxes of implementation. So just one quick example of that is if you look at democracy promotion activities in countries, particularly countries that are less democratic, and I think one of the examples I give in the book is a program from Turkmenistan. Well, Turkmenistan is very far by any measure from being a democratic country, and you know it's not really meaningfully moving in that direction. But the programs in that country are very technical, right? So there was an example I give is a program where the USAID worked with the government of Turkmenistan to do things like train their government officials and bureaucrats how to use Skype more effectively. That was one of the examples given in the research I found. And the paradox is that this is a technical solution to what is a political problem, right? Well, absence of democracy is a political problem, but the programming around it at the USAID level or the NED or all the NGOs we support are technical because you can't get funding for a program that says our goal here is to overthrow the government. You then get kicked out of the country.
Right.
So that's another paradox. So those are the three main directions of the paradox.
So from what you're just explaining, too, the varieties of democracy promotion, the mechanics of it run along a scale from very technical to what? To actual invasions?
Well, for the most part, from very technical to slightly less technical.
Okay.
Most of the programs involved with democracy promotion are technical. Now, there are exceptions. If we think of countries like Belarus, you know, North Korea, Cuba, where there is a consensus that these are both non-democratic countries and not friendly to the United States. Because if there's a non-democratic country that's and also not very powerful, if you click all three boxes, then the democracy promotion is a little bit more aggressive. The problem is you can't really operate easily in those countries for all of those reasons. So, you know, our Belarus programming tends to be based in Ukraine, it tends to be based in the Baltics, and it's sending people in. It's trying to do a few things, but you can't really have much influence that way. That's just how it's very difficult if you're not in the country.
You mentioned in the case of Belarus in the book that democracy promotion efforts are not tied to the government, which is authoritarian, but to civil society, with the goal of regime change. Doesn't that kind of policy confirm the views of critics like Russia's Putin that democracy promotion is actually an instrument of U.S. foreign policy solely?
Well, I think the way I would respond to that is yes and no. It is an instrument of U.S. policy. I mean, it is done through USAID, most of our democracy promotion funding, which is part of the State Department. So, you know, definitionally, it's part of U.S. policy. U.S. policy is not always one of regime change. Belarus is an extreme example. Right? Another example I would give is Azerbaijan, which is over the last 3 years has become increasingly authoritarian. And we are very much not committed to regime change in Azerbaijan because, well, they've got a lot of oil and it's kind of a complicated security role they play because of their proximity both to Russia and Iran, and we kind of need them as an ally. All of that is, you know, you can certainly make a kind of realist argument for doing all of those things, as both President Obama, who's been president for most, you know, for this period, and his successor, will, assuming he's one of the more rational candidates, probably will do. But if that's the case, then what is the point of doing democracy promotion? You see, Putin is wrong about that. Our goal is not to overthrow the government of Azerbaijan, right? Nor is it to overthrow the government of lots of other kind of semi-authoritarian countries around the world. But the only way to make those countries democratic would be to overthrow them. And since we're not going to do that, what is the goal? Are we just trying to make things a little more liberal, a little more reform? That's not really democracy promotion.
What, in general, is your assessment of the Obama administration's democracy promotion efforts?
I think if we look at post-Cold War democracy promotion, you know, beginning with Clinton, President Clinton, and going through President Bush, and now the Obama administration, I think the first cut at explaining this is always, you know, a narrative of change. You know, we had this kind of neocon moment and the freedom agenda under President Bush and then this pullback under President Obama. But in my view, a more useful, although frankly not as exciting way to look at it is one of continuity, right? Budgets have changed, not as dramatically as possible, as many think, right? The programs are alarmingly similar. I mean, I still do enough democracy work, and I still talk to enough people in the field that when I go to countries, I'm amazed that some of these programs, if you update it because, you know, the internet wasn't quite what it was 15 years ago, what it is today 15 years ago, these are really very programmatically very similar, right? What's changed mostly is the rhetorical emphasis, right? If you go back and look at many of the speeches Bush has made over the years, there's this constant aim of, you know, freedom is essentially something God gave to the Americans, and the Americans are going to give it to the rest of the world, whether they like it or not. But programmatically, outside of Afghanistan and Iraq, it's not that dramatically different today than it was. I mean, in other words, Bush's democracy promotion work was not that dramatically different than Clinton's, other than those two countries. Admittedly, that may be a little bit like saying, other than that, this is Lincoln, how was the show? But just bear with me. And then when Obama came in, the rhetoric disappeared. It's very hard to find a speech where Obama really goes all out saying, you know, we will bring democracy to the rest of the world. This is our mission. But the programs and the funding didn't change as dramatically as many think. So, you know, and for me, that very importantly reflects, and this is also one of the paradoxes, that there is among the foreign policy establishment, there is a broad consensus around the value and necessity and kind of the need to keep doing democracy promotion work. But among the American people, you know, when I talk to people this because, you know, I don't know how important, but when I tell people what I do, they shrug their shoulders and laugh, right? Or they say, well, why don't we try doing that here? Mm. All of which are legitimate points. So there is this gap between the foreign policy establishment and the rest of the American people. And moving forward, the best indicator for how much a president will be committed to ongoing democracy promotion work, you know, as we get ready to elect a new president, is how much is that president a product with regards to foreign policy of the foreign policy establishment? And you can look at the remaining candidates and kind of slot them in as you think fit, given that criteria. And that's probably as good an indicator as that.
You mentioned that when you tell people what you do, they kind of shrug their shoulders. How did you end up doing democracy promotion work?
Well, my path is a very circuitous one. I have a PhD in political science, so I've always been interested in politics and political institutions, although my initial work in political science was on domestic politics. And I ran campaigns in New York City for many years, which is actually a good, surprisingly good training because and then I got a job at NDI in Georgia, and I worked for them for 2 years during the period
National,
of the Revolution.
NDI being the National Democratic Institute,
which is probably the largest American democracy promoting NGO. Mm-hmm. And then I began, after I left that position, I consulted for them, and I consulted for other organizations. And now most of the work I do in democracy promotion is evaluating, program evaluation. But you know, it's substantively, this is absolutely fascinating work. It's extraordinary to go to a country, really get your hands dirty with the politics, learn a lot. And there are many people, I would say the majority of the people in the field, not all, but the majority really are doing this for the right reasons. And that's, I mean, when you hear words like imperialist thrown around and regime change, And then you meet the people, you know, especially the better people who many of them do could be making more money at home and, you know, not having to send their kids to inferior schools and all of that kind of thing. It's very hard to square that circle, right? But that doesn't mean that the critique isn't entirely wrong. But there's a lot of very good people who believe in this. And the notion that, you know, all over the world, people have the right to maybe choose who their leaders are, that's not a crazy or reactionary or imperialist idea. So there's a real complexity to it.
Has your sense of how democracy promotion works or doesn't work changed from your early days when you were part of the Rose Revolution, or not a part of it, but were there in Georgia when the Rose Revolution occurred, to today?
Well, you know, the Rose Revolution was an interesting event for a number of reasons. And it was kind of the second or the first, depending on who's counting, of the color revolutions, which were this moment where it was almost the height of democracy promotion, because unlike, you know, other events in the recent history of democracy, the American democracy organizations were really at the center of these. I don't know that they were, it was an American plot, as our friend Vladimir Putin might suggest, but they were at the center of these color revolutions. But particularly in Georgia, relatively quickly, the democratic promise of the Rose Revolution subsided. So, you know, on the one hand, from a kind of substantive approach, what that showed is that the work we're doing, you know, there's something that's not clicking, something that's not breaking through. And then as I began to spend more time, you know, outside of just Georgia and just the former Soviet Union working on these, I really did get the sense that there is a, you know, that this is a policy that the rationale for it needs to be examined more, and that the programs, I mean, I still frequently, you know, my general experience when I evaluate programs is that, you know, depending on the program, it can be implemented very effectively in many cases. But the story of how this program is going to lead to that country becoming more democratic is a hard one to tell, and a hard one in which to believe. And if it's a hard one in which to believe, you have to kind of ask the question of why are we doing this, given the downs to the cost, not just the money cost, but, you know, the problems associated with doing this. Of course, the other side of it is that you see that there are problems associated with not doing it, right?
Do you consider
yourself if you're involved with the country for 20 years supporting NGOs that are doing good things, and then you walk away, right? It looks like the United States has quit, and we don't support our friends.
So do you consider yourself a skeptic now?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I'm not an opponent of democracy promotion. I'm not someone who says we should just, you know, fold up the tent and go home like a number of people in the Congress who have called for, you know, defunding USAID. But I would be a proponent for saying we should really think this through and confront the questions that I outlined. And that's really my conclusion in the book, is that these paradoxes are real. And if you rationalize them away and pretend they're not there, it's very easy to make policy, right? If you pretend that those governments with which we're working really are committed to democracy, the rest of the programs all make sense. But you're not going to achieve the results because you're basing your program on pretending something. So wrestling, if you pretend that these are just technical solutions, that the real problem Turkmenistan isn't democratic is because their bureaucrats don't know how to use Skype, then it's very easy to get to a programmatic outcome that works. The problem is it's based on make-believe. So I'm really, the message of this book to practitioners, besides buy it and read it, is to wrestle with the very serious, difficult questions, because otherwise you're just not going to get good policy.
Lincoln, thanks for taking the time to talk to us today.
My pleasure.
You can find out more about and purchase The Democracy Promotion Paradox by Lincoln Mitchell on the Brookings website, brookings.edu.